Greetings, everyone. You probably do not know that for many years in Ambassador College, I taught several of the major Bible study courses, the upper level as well as graduate. For many, many years, we didn't have any classes in prophecy, and so when I had systematic theology at the second year level and we were surveying the Old Testament, I would go through, beginning clear back in the tables of nations in Genesis 10 and elsewhere, and develop prophecy all the way through the three major prophecies, and then later on taught for several years a graduate lesson in the minor prophets, although there's nothing really minor about such books as Hosea and Daniel and so on. And for perhaps many, many years in hundreds of radio programs, I've talked about the prophecies of Matthew 24 and Luke 21 and Mark 13, the book of Revelation. I've gone through dozens of programs where I've expounded every word of the book of Revelation serially and have an album on that that we have available. It's been a long time since I've spoken on that subject here. Do you want me to wear this peanut microphone, I assume, for some purpose? I'll put it on, okay. But I thought it was probably overdue for the simple reason that oftentimes people decide they're going to flee somewhere. Now, in the parent organization, they have been ready to flee, one foot in the air, ear cocked for the gun lap, for about 15 years, and especially in the last 6 years. I don't think there has been a single Passover or a single Feast of Tabernacles, but what just barely before that period of time, generally because they hope they will all be in one place, they will all be together, they'll be among their friends, they'll be at the feet of the leadership, etc., and they're going to flee somewhere. It was only about a year and a half ago, you remember perhaps seeing national headlines, and I think television news covered it. I think I even saw an interview on Good Morning America of a teacher somewhere over in Tucson who decided to set the date for the rapture. And it was Tuesday the 13th at 9:30 or something, and they interviewed this guy, and I mean, he was as positive as anybody you've ever seen. He was facing CBS and NBC microphones, oh yes, we're going to flee and be with the Lord, he's going to whisk us away to heaven. And well, the interviewer said, well, what happens if you don't? Well, that's not possible. It is going to happen and you will see, and on and on. So of course, dutifully, the day or two after the event was supposed to happen, they come back to interview the guy, and he was kind of digging his toe around in the sand and kind of crossing and uncrossing his legs and picking at non-existent lint on his trousers, a little embarrassed. Well, we've got to rethink it a little bit. We need to go back and relook at that. I have been dumbfounded at the number of would-be prophets who really have not lost any credibility. They have not even lost followers or support oftentimes by coming up with some of the most grotesque lies that have ever been concocted. There was a guy that went off in some small town in Oregon from the parent organization many, many years ago and built himself a little church organization. He was prone to lay a lot of heavy emphasis on demons and esoterica and hidden mysteries and secrets and weird things and prophecies especially. Now, you know, in ancient Babylonia and Assyria and all of the nations with which Israel came into contact, the Philistines and others, they had a tremendous respect for the future, and a desire to know and to understand the future. And every one of those great kings had what were called soothsayers, astrologers, stargazers, prognosticators. They had people whose professional expertise was in so-called astronomy, or in tarot cards, or bat's knuckles and frog's legs, or the way your hair fell after they cut some of it off, or whatever. And they would foretell the future. You can read of that in the book of Daniel, of how when this dream occurred, Nebuchadnezzar was willing to put to death his own soothsayers, astrologers, and stargazers, because they couldn't give him the answer. So far, I guess, as there have been people to stand up on their soapbox and spout off prophecies, there have been people who have been willing to follow a false prophet. I have been labeled such very recently on national television. Somebody said that there was some guy that got carried away with giving you his forbidden list of false prophets, and he said, Garner Ted Armstrong is a false prophet. And the person that heard this got a little upset because they said, now how can that be? I don't understand how they can get away with it myself. I've never done that, to just list a group of names and say so-and-so is an idiot and so-and-so is a freak and so-and-so is a false prophet and don't follow him. I don't think that's what I'm called to do. But it has been amazing to me that would-be teachers can come up with weird doctrines and ideas, even promulgating disaster. I mean disaster of mind-boggling proportions. The death of, say, a few million people. You know, hurricanes, typhoons, droughts, famines, the disintegration of whole empires and nations, and say, therefore, since I know the secret, I'm in on the little inside key. I'm the guy that discovered the little secret badge in the cereal box, and I know the secret handshake, and I'm one of the initiated in esoterica. I know the mysteries from Ecclesiasticus or Judith or the Book of Ruth. Follow me. So everybody says, yeah, okay, I will, but where are we going? And they don't go anywhere. Year after year, people are going to flee. I have in my office a whole stack of old Plain Truth magazines. I've been doing a little bit of research back into what we used to say. I've been to the Tyler Library, which unfortunately is quite small, but at least it has a certain amount of history in Assyrian history and German history and so on. So I've been getting a few quotes out of that and working on a couple of chapters in my book on the United States in prophecy, because one of the chapters is going to deal with Germany in prophecy. Now, in one of these old articles, there is a headline, USA writing to total collapse in 20 short years, written in about 1954. Kids, it's 1984. Now, you can add 54 and 20, and you come up with 74, right? But 10 years ago, there was no apology. In that same magazine, 10 years later, there was no big headline, oops, you know, or we goofed, or error, or mistake, or we're sorry, or we shouldn't have said that because we were a little bit wrong. Now, for years and years and years, I taught, as did many others, the idea of 19-year time cycles, that everything happened according to cycles. We got into numerology. We looked at Ivan Panin's Greek Numerics New Testament and decided there were all sorts of systems of numbers and so on in the Bible. And to some degree, that is correct, but what are you going to make of it other than the fact that it's one more corroboration of the fact that the Bible is the Word of God? So what I want to say is, prophecy is not spooky, it is not astrological, it is not voodoo, it isn't stargazing or crystal ball gazing, it isn't reading cards or lines in your hands, it is not some reason to become mystical or superstitious. It is not for the purpose of inciting fear. It is not put in the Bible for the purpose of giving a would-be spiritual leader a club with which he can control and rule through fear his audience. A third of the Bible is prophecy. We read in books of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, all kinds of prophecies having to do with Israel and Judah and with many, many other nations that are mentioned, all of whom can be discovered according to their modern names. Now, in the opening chapters of the United States and British Commonwealth in Prophecy booklet, I have redone it from scratch, and I'm not plagiarizing anybody. I went back to Allen's book, and I'm quoting from him liberally, and this time giving him credit, which was never done in the original booklet. And by the time I'm through with the book, it'll probably be about the size of the real Jesus or Peter's story, or maybe even somewhat larger, and will contain not only the many, many proofs, of which there are quite a number, of the identity of the United States and the British Commonwealth of people in biblical prophecy, but also the identity of the German people, and perhaps the identity of some of the other Israelitish peoples of northwestern Europe as well. Prophecy is history written in advance, because after all, God has a purpose in you and I walking around on the earth. Humankind does not represent a divine experiment. We are not God's playthings. We are not a cosmic accident. So prophecy really is only part of a scenario. It's history written in advance. It is basic. It is not finely detailed in every last little detail, you might say, getting right down to the so-called nitty-gritty, but is more or less of an overview or an outline as human events would be expected to develop, looking at human nature, together with some of those very special events in which God would deliberately intervene from time to time. Now, you know, history merely means his
story. And someone has said the only thing we learn from history is that we never learn anything from history. And that was true in Vietnam, as it was in Korea, looking at World War II, and it will be true again if we get into it in South or Central America, down in Honduras. I want you to turn to a couple of the major prophecies of the New Testament, Jesus' own words. And I want to ask the question as we look at these prophecies, and look at them literally and specifically, not esoterically or mystically, Matthew 24, 15 and 16, why would anyone expect that there would be any event other than these events right here which would cause anyone to flee anywhere? And yet, every now and then when I pick up a letter from, as I say, the parent church, it is saying that we're about to flee, and you will be dumbfounded at how many thousands and thousands of them there are who absolutely, almost fearfully, like I said, I made a little lame attempt at humor, that they're with one foot in the air in the gun lap. But, you know, looking at the Olympics for the past couple of weeks, the analogy kind of comes to me about the gun lap. And it never fails that when some great event is about to occur in the church, like the Passover, the Days of Unleavened Bread, or the Feast of Tabernacles, that people's minds turn once again toward, it must be time to flee. They're about to go somewhere. Matthew 24 and verse 14 and 15, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. The Bible talks about the end. The end of what? Well, it makes it very clear it is not the end of the physical earth, it's not the end of all of mankind, but it is the end of civilization as we presently know it, with man-made governments in control. When you therefore, says Christ to his own personal disciples, at that time, in that place, then, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, you can go back to Daniel and see when he said that, but Daniel 12:11 and other scriptures that infer the same thing, when the great power that was that little horn that overthrew the three horns before it would stand up even against the prince of the covenant, and that the power of the holy people would be broken, etc. When you see that abomination of desolation, another wording of this is the abomination that makes desolation or brings about destruction, spoken of by Daniel, stand in the holy place. Let's understand it. What is the holy place? The Holy of Holies was a small interior part of the tabernacle of wilderness, later the temple under Solomon, and now the temple in the Herodian period. And outside of it was called the holy place, and that was the place where the priests would do the daily burnt sacrifices and offerings and so on. And it was certainly very, very holy to the Judaic religion. Whoso readeth, let him understand. Why the parenthetical caution? He's saying, be careful with this. Don't leap to conclusions. If you read it, if you read what Daniel said, let him understand it. And possibly, and I think this is true, Matthew adds his little parenthetical footnote. Jesus didn't say that. I think Matthew put it in. Whoever reads this after I write it better understand it. Then let them which be in Judea. Now, is there any question in your mind, since you're here in Tyler on South Broadway, in Tyler, Texas, the state of Texas, you know, in the United States of America, as to whether that is talking to you? If you have a doubt, I would wonder, are we reading from the same Bible? Now, I know that you could have a very clever way of saying, yes, but this meant his disciples. And so it's his disciples wherever they are. But why does he revert to the word them instead of you? Why does he not say, let you, wherever you are, flee somewhere? But he says, let them which be in Judea. Why? Well, because the event he's talking about is going to take place in Judea. He's saying when you see a filthy abomination which is going to cause death and torture and destruction standing in the holy place where it has no business being, then the people right there in that environment ought to flee or else they die. They get tortured and they die. It makes sense. Let them which be in Judea flee. Where? Into the mountains, plural. Not one mountain, not a valley, not a cave, not a specific place named after the physical topographical characteristics of the place, but mountains, plural. And if you look at the mountains, the relief map or whatever, of ancient Judea and of the area around Jerusalem today, you will see that there are dozens of mountains, and they are quite precipitous and stark and ugly in many cases, especially over on the Jordanian side, and desolate and barren and bleak and inhospitable, and you can die there in a very short period of time. But on the other hand, if God is protecting you, they are very, very difficult for any tanks or troops or anyone else to operate in because they're very precipitous. He says that there is an urgency to this, and it says verse 17, which is why I really tend to wonder whether you will have time to line up with your ticket in your hand to go aboard a DC-10, or whether you will really go aboard the old Queen Mary, which will be outfitted with new turbines and new engines and so on, and you will all be at the Feast of Tabernacles with your tickets all lining up and ready to go. The reason I say that is because of what it says here in Christ's own words. Let him which is on the housetop, and you know the road of the roof spoken of by the rabbi, they had uniform housetops. You could go up from the end of the block, walk along all the houses in the block, and go down the other end, and that was where they took the sun if they wanted it, or the shade in the late afternoon, where they hung up their clothing, where they would chat with one another, where they would do what we do in our patios. That was their patio, was the roof. And if they were up there doing whatever they would be doing, drying clothes or chatting or eating, don't come down to take anything out of his house. There's two ways they can go down. Walk along and just disappear over the edge down where the street is and escape, or they can go down inside their own home. We have such a housetop in the office in Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, many of the houses, even today, still have a deck on a stone area where they'll have a rain-collecting cistern and so on, where they even have rainfall collected in cisterns within the walls of the building, and a purification or a filtration system, and it's cooled. And we have that in our own office building in Ramallah, over in the former Arab or Jordanian section of Jerusalem. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take any item out of his house. That includes children, pets, whether they're parrots or monkeys, doesn't it? Don't get inside the house. Doesn't that tell you that this is a very urgent, a very sudden event that you hear and you see with your eyes in the streets of Jerusalem in Judea? Why does Christ go to such detail to warn what is going to happen in that specific area if he's talking about people in Medford, Oregon, fleeing somewhere? I'd love to be in Medford, Oregon when it all comes down. That Rogue River area nearby, I mean, the Oregonian Cascade Mountains and some of those southern Oregonian mountains are about as remote and desolate and beautiful as any you would ever want to be in. Beats the Rockies, I think, from just sheer desolation. Nowhere near as many people are backpackers up in the Rockies. I know, I just came back from there. And even the trails sometimes are busy. And woe, no, in the field, it says, verse 18, let him which is in the field not, neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. So if you're in the field, you notice something going on, you don't even go back to your home to get some clothes and pack. Woe to those that are with child. Doesn't that say then that a woman has the choice? I like to drink meaning out of scriptures. It also says something else that people basically do not understand, including the Catholics. It says that women have a choice, doesn't it? It says there is a time when, because of world conditions, a woman could elect not to become pregnant. And I think those who do not agree that the Bible allows the idea of limiting a family to two or three instead of having children like popcorn for about 40 years till you got 14 or so, like they do in some of the Central and South American nations, that the Catholics are not correct in what they say. Woe unto them that are with child, and to those that are nursing a child in those days. But pray you that your flight be not in the winter. Problem. Did Christ know at the time that he spoke that somewhere it's always winter? Well, of course he did. So we're dealing with Judea, aren't we? But not with Australia and South Africa on the one hand, or northern Germany, Scandinavia, Iceland, and Canada on the other hand, are we? It could not be an answered prayer to all of them at once unless God does something akin to what he did in the day that he stopped the sun for Joshua and caused it to be summer everywhere. Neither on the Sabbath day, for then, when you see the abomination of desolation, then shall be great tribulation such as was not from the beginning of the world of this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive, as it adds in Moffat. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Now to Luke 21 and verse 20, we get the other aspect of this, and I'll just read the one verse. And when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies. So both elements of this obtain. The so-called abomination of desolation, whatever that is, and armies. So it appears to be both a religio-military combine of some sort that imposes upon them the desecration of the Jewish holy place or the temple under threat or the force of intervention of arms. When you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them which are in Judea, Luke is true to Christ's own statement, he does not make any error, flee to the mountains, and let them which are in that general area, in the midst of Judea, which is a large province, depart out, and let not them that are in the countries, that includes the United States of America, we're one of the countries, enter into that area, enter there into. Why would anyone want to leave Washington State, as I've said time and again, fight his way all across the United States, several mountain ranges, try to take ship, get to Europe, get all the way across Europe, or else go through the Mediterranean, end up in the most war-torn, horrible area in the world with every known faction there is, all of them possessing French and West German and American and Soviet-made super-sophisticated weapons, fight their way like some refugee through all of that, get into one of the most hostile Arab nations on the face of the earth under King Hussein, fight their way through scorpions and rattlesnakes to a desert and get into a cave called Petra. When Christ says, if you're anywhere but in the Judean area, don't go to that region of the world, stay out of there. Now, as I've said, prophecy is not to give would-be leaders spiritual badges. God condemns time and again soothsayers and those that peep and mutter, astrologers and stargazers and on and on. What is this abomination of desolation? I believe it is discovered in history, and you can look it up in some of the Bible encyclopedias under the reference to this scripture right here, under the reference to Daniel 12. Kiddo's Bible Cyclopedia is a good one. Some of the Bible handbooks are. Some of the commentators are. And they will tell you, as does Bullinger's Companion Bible by Zondervan Publishing, that in all there will have been, apparently, seven desecrations of the temple. That there have been more than just the one. And that not only did Antiochus Epiphanes sacrifice swine's blood in the Holy of Holies on one of the attacks and the occupations of Jerusalem, but they set up a statue of Jupiter Olympus after the sack and the pillaging of Jerusalem under the armies of Titus in 71 A.D. That has happened time and again. It's going to happen once again. In Daniel, let's turn to the book of Daniel and the 12th chapter. You see that basically all prophecy falls into one major category. That is a category of concealment from the masses where most people do not understand. In concluding, and I've pointed out time and again that the 11th chapter of Daniel is the longest prophecy in all the Bible. It is the most detailed, and it is given by an archangel. It is given by an archangel in first-person quotation, and one of those segments of the Bible, it is a quotation from one of the great creatures that stands alongside the throne of God. He continues summarizing that great prophecy, beginning in the 12th chapter, verse 1, at that time, time that we'll come back to and define in a moment, which is really the same time we just read of, shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people. Michael is one of the three archangels mentioned in the Bible. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even at that same time. It's got to be the same time, right? Because they can't mutually cancel out each other. When Christ says a time of trouble such as was never from the beginning of the world until now, and Daniel says a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation till now, same time, the time of the great tribulation. And at that time, thy people shall be delivered, every one that is found written in the book, talking again about God's heavenly record. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, so it's talking about the resurrection which occurs at the end of this event, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting abhorrence or contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that are doing the work of God. Now, I want to just emphasize that because it says, they that turn many to righteousness, those that are engaged in doing that work. Another clue as to what the church is supposed to be doing. Not static, not just waiting it out, but busily turning other individuals to the truth of God and to the right way of life. Will shine as the stars forever and ever. Verse 4. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Well, and he saw this man, and he asked again, how long is it going to be? And he said in the last verse 7, it'll be for a time and times and a half, and when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. And I heard, but I understood not. Verse 8. And then I said, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? He was curious and wanted to know. How can I understand? When will I know? What can I do about it? And he said, go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly. It'll seem that the world goes along just like it always has. And none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. So it doesn't mean that this is closed irrevocably from that time till the end of the age, but the wise shall understand. Now back in the 11th chapter, beginning in verse 40, we've read this time and again it refers to the time of the end. In verse 40, and at the time of the end, the conclusion of the longest prophecy in all of the Bible, shall the king of the south push at him. If you read all that comes up to it, it introduces the Ptolemaic kingdoms of Egypt, who were the various Ptolemies, or in other words, a lesser line of pharaohs, and the Seleucids, or the Seleucidae, of Syria, and that occupied a part of the Anatolian Peninsula, which is modern-day Turkey, and the wars that were waged in that area. And they are even virtually named. In Rawlinson's history, his Seven Ancient Empires and others, actually, virtually, without Rawlinson even knowing what he was doing, expounds and explains all that took place here, verse by verse, up until verse 40. The king of the south will push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen, with many ships. He shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. And it defines the land of Palestine. He will enter into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom, which is Esau or Turkey, and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon, which is basically Iraq and Jordan. Ammon is still the capital of Jordan today. He will stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. I pointed out in recent years that that could not have been understood in its present context until the Camp David Accords during the Carter administration, which is incredible when you stop to think about it. Why would a northern power moving into the Middle East conquer and occupy both Israel and Egypt when for generations Egypt and Israel have been implacable enemies? But now it seems that there is some sort of an accord, or else Egypt is at such variance with her other Arab neighbors that when Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon or Ammon are left outside of this area, Egypt is not accepted and is occupied by this northern power. There's some differentiation made between Egypt, and I'm wondering even now about the mining of the Red Sea and the approaches to the Suez, and whether or not it is Libya, or whether or not it's Saudi Arabia, or whether or not it's the Iranians, or whether or not it's some faction inside of Egypt, although I don't know how they could get their hands on the mines or have the military equipment to do it. But even right now, as we speak, sit here today, the British Americans, British and Americans both, perhaps some others from Europe, are assisting Egypt in sweeping mines because there have been several ships that have struck mines in that area, and they don't know why. Egypt is not that popular with some of her Arab neighbors, in spite of the fact that Egypt is largely underwritten by Saudi Arabia financially. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and of course from the time of the Yom Kippur War, the gold and the silver of the modern nations have flown in an ever-ending stream into the coffers of the Arab Gulf states, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians. Mistranslation, shouldn't read that, because you cannot read Libya, modern map, Ethiopia, Eritrea, modern map. It's Cush and Put. And Cush or Cushites are the Indians, and Put are the North African, Central African tribes that are black. So basically it's saying he's going to occupy the Near and the Middle East up to basically the borders of India, and two, the borders probably south of Ethiopia, Eritrea, and the Sudan, to probably Tanzania, Kenya, some of those areas. But tidings out of the east and out of the north, where is north and east from Palestine but Soviet Russia, shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy, and utterly to make away many. He shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Look how this substantiates what Jesus said in Matthew 24 and Luke 21. Here is a military occupation of Palestine. Obviously, though this does not deal with it in this particular scripture, it includes the desolation of the holy place by some sort of an abomination. It includes the encirclement or the occupying of the city of Jerusalem. And that includes the warning of those who are in Judea to flee. We've already read the 12th chapter that summarizes a little bit. As I've said, it is easy, basically, to identify the United States in prophecy. And I've done that over the years. My father has before me. His book is quite accurate. There may be some credits that ought to be due to Allen's book that should be in there, but nevertheless, the book stands up and it is accurate. And what I have written from scratch, although I've certainly learned it over the years and done a lot of research on it myself, and have been to England and some of the areas there, the British Museum and elsewhere, and looked up some of the original old books myself. I want to show you now where Germany is identified in biblical prophecy, and some clues that might lend its help toward further research on your part. We all know that the Germanic people have many different racial origins. No modern nation, basically, certainly the United States is a case in point, is of any one blood or any one race. We say that we are Americans. Now, you stop to think about the origin of that word, it's really rather ludicrous in a way, because it has no connotation of our color or our racial origins or our language or our culture, but is merely the first name of an Italian who was one of the original discoverers after the time of Columbus of the United States proper. Americus Vespucci, or Vespucius as they say, anglicizing it. So we are Americans, and we take the first name of a man who was a discoverer who happened to be an Italian. The names of other nations are similar. They have the craziest origins you can imagine. Do you know where the name German comes from? German is really a corrupted, anglicized pronunciation of the word Teuton, which was the Roman attempt to pronounce the word that was spoken by barbarians that caused the Romans to build the famous Limes, or the Romish Wall, all along the Vistula and other rivers to try to keep the invading barbarians of Central Europe out of the Roman Empire in about the 1st and the 2nd century before Christ. They called their spears Teut. And they all used spears, but they were not throwing spears. They were more like a pike that they held, and they were barbarians, but they were also people who were very warlike and who seemed to glory in war. So when the Romans came among them, and one of the most interesting books was written by one of the Roman historians called, I think later on out of the Latin, it was finally translated in Britain, and there are copies in a British museum, so it's called Germania, but that was not its original title. And he said that those men called themselves Teutons, or Teutones, which is what the Romans called them. So the Teutons, as we pronounce it today, merely meant spearmen. Actually, the word German is a modern anglicized corruption, as the languages of these Indo-Aryan or Indo-European races gradually resulted in, believe it or not, Icelandic, Norwegian, Swedish, Danish, High and Low German, Dutch, and English. Every one of those languages came from the barbarian tongues of the Central European peoples, who were basically Hessians, or the Catti, or the Chitti, or the Hatti, and we can look that up in any encyclopedia you would like, or the Schwabians, or the Thuringians, or those of the various areas of Saxony, or Schleswig-Holstein, or some of the other states of Germany. If you study some of the histories of Germany, you will find there were two major tribes that were linked together at that time, and it is no wonder that they were, because they got linked together, as we will see if we turn to 1st 2 Kings, the 17th chapter, clear back at the time of the dispossession of the peoples of Israel during the attack under King Shalmaneser. In 2 Kings 17, I'll only read part of this, but Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, made Hoshea his servant. Verse 3, the king of Assyria found conspiracy in him. Verse 4, had shut him up and put him in prison. 3 years took place, verse 5, during which the king of Assyria besieged all of Samaria. Samaria was the capital of what? Israel, the northern 10 tribes. Remember that there are 4 whole books of the Bible devoted to the totally separate national histories, 2 totally separate dynasties of kings, of Israel to the north and Judah to the south. 718, 721 B.C., they were all taken captive. Verse 18, therefore the Eternal was very angry with Israel and removed them out of his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah, from which the word Jew comes, only. Also, Judah kept not the commandments of the Eternal their God, etc., etc. It says in verse 21, he rent Israel from the house of David. We know how during the days of Rehoboam and Jeroboam they split. Verse 23, until the Eternal removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said by all his servants the prophets, so was Israel, the northern 10 tribes, carried away out of their own land to Assyria unto this day. And the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon, and from Cutha, and Ava, and Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. Interestingly enough, I found in some of the histories that they say that the peoples of Central Europe and the ancient Assyrians had the practice, when they overcame an enemy in war, of dispossession of their captives and of completely unsettling the populaces, because they knew that they were leaving the seeds of potential rebellion, of subversion, fifth column activity, etc., and the eventual loosening of their hold on conquered lands in place if they left these peoples in their own lands, in their own culture, in their own language in place. So they invariably completely deported them. It even stated of the ancient Assyrians that many of their developments were the result of slave labor. I found that fascinating, some of the national and the racial characteristics that have stuck with them. So it was at the beginning of their dwelling there, verse 25, that they feared not the Eternal. So the Eternal sent lions among them, which slew some of them. Wherefore they spake to the king of Assyria, saying, these Babylonians and other captive peoples moved into the northern Israelitish cities, and said that they didn't know the manner of the God of the land. So it said they sent one priest, verse 27, and he can go and teach them the manner of the God of the land. Then one of the priests that they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel, it meant the house of the Lord, and taught them how they should fear the Eternal. They were utterly removed out of the land, and they began to wander. If you look under the article, let me see. Okay, in the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser in the British Museum is a picture that I have actually seen of King Jehu on his knees before Shalmaneser, and Shalmaneser is boasting that I took tribute of the people of Bet Homri. Now Omri, O-M-R-I, was one of the lesser known kings of northern Israel in the Bible, but the greatest known king among all of the other Gentile tribes around because of his various conquests and enlargement of the land. And the ancient Babylonian and Assyrian cuneiform mentions Omri. But in their tongue, the house of Omri in English is house of Omri. But in Hebrew, it was Bet Homri. In their language, it became Bet Kumri. And we find them all the way along from the Black and Caspian Sea to the Danube, to Central Europe, and clear on up into northwestern Germany as the Kimri, the Gymiri, G-Y-M-I-R-R-I, C-Y-M-B-R-I, and the C-I-M-M-I-R-I-A-N-S, or the Cimmerians. This, again, is a little bit in philology, and I think philological understanding of the transmission of various languages is necessary and important in some of these studies. If you know that there is no such word, for example, as German in ancient history, and actually the word in Latin is Aleman. That comes from a totally different origin than Teuton, by the way. Teuton, which is pronounced, by the way, the T and the D are interchangeable in some of these languages, especially in Low German. So Teutsch became Deutsch, and actually Deutschland is nothing more than a German language or linguistical corruption of the ancient pronunciation of spear land or spearmen's land. And literally, the word Deutschland means a land of warriors or a land of spearmen. But Germany is an English anglicized word that just sort of derives philologically from those tongues. In the Latin, it was Alemannia, coming from one of the chief tribes of ancient Assyria, who were the Chatti, C-H-A-T-T-I, and the Alemans, or the A-L-E-M-A-N-S. Alemanni, or the Halmanni, were the peoples who migrated into the Bavarian part, the mountainous part of Germany, and up along the Baltic is where the Chatti, and if you study any article in the Britannica, 11th edition, the Americana even having a little article on it, the World Book will probably have it, and you will see under the article Hessia, or Hesse, H-E-S-S-E. You remember that during our American Revolutionary War, we imported Hessians because of their martial and military proclivities, and it was Hessians that actually helped us defeat the British and become a free nation. The origin of the earliest tribes in the area of Hesse were the Chatti or the Hatti, nothing more than one of the two principal tribes of ancient Assyria. I've already written a little bit of this, and I want to give you some of it out of one of the chapters I'm writing for the booklet. Some of the other important tribal names applied to the Germanic people by the Romans were Hatti, I've mentioned, Alemanni and Halmanni, the Saubi, Causari, Quadi, and so on. That's in the Britannica 11th edition under the article Germany. Surprising claims are made in some of the ancient German histories. There's a man who is named Joseph K.H. Biel, B-I-H-L. He wrote a book called In Deutschen Landen, and he says, and I quote, "The inhabitants of Trier, one of the oldest of all of the four oldest cities of Germany, maintain that their city is the oldest in all Europe." And he says, and I quote, "Trier was founded by Trebetta, a son of the famous Assyrian king Ninus." And Ninus is another name for Nimrod. In fact, one finds in Trier, archaeologists unearthed an inscription which read, "Trier existed for 1,300 years before Rome was built." Now, why is that surprising? In a recent edition of the National Geographic, I saw some of the most incredible archaeological excavations in Bulgaria. They showed an ancient king with his chariot, with actually all of these men lined up there, gold and bronze and so on. As I've been doing some further research into this, I am dumbfounded at the amount of knowledge that was possessed by the ancient Assyrians. They understood, apparently, optics. I'll tell you why I think so. Because some of the cuneiform tablets, which were actually either used by inscribing in wet clay or else stamping in wet clay, are so tiny that they have to be read by a magnifying glass. There's absolute proof that the ancient Assyrians were familiar with glass blowing because some of the relics have been found, and even pictures in their monuments of people doing glass blowing. I confess, I don't know how to do that. Metallurgy, you can look it up and you can see, and I'll give you a quote a little later on, that they had metal chariot wheels, metals of all types, including iron and bronze. And if you know anything about iron ore, would you be able to walk out here up around Pittsburgh and tell me which is iron ore and which is not? Would you know how to smelt it, how to put it in a Bessemer oven, how to melt coal down to coke, how to use a bellows to get the coke so hot it would actually melt the metal out of the rock, and how to take the slag piles off from it and purify it, how to smelt it and make it in molds into armor or chariot wheels or spears or swords or so on. They were quite advanced, quite more so than we would perhaps like to think. I then quote Genesis 10, I won't turn to that now, about how Nimrod, or Ninus, went forth into Asher and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, and Calah, and so on. The ancient Assyrians had outstanding racial characteristics. They believed themselves to be the master race. They believed there was nothing more glorious than conquest by war. A child's first important toy, reminds us of us, was a spear or a sword. Assyrian kings and heroes are invariably shown in war chariots, spearing lions in hand-to-hand combat with lions or bulls, or with their foes being tortured, dismembered, or beneath them. And it will show all sorts of soldiers behind them, and enemies over whom they have gained victory being trampled underfoot. And there are not just a few, by the way, but thousands of them. There are still hundreds and hundreds of Babylonian and Assyrian cuneiform tablets in the British Museum that have never even been deciphered. There's a wealth of information there that has never even been studied. The Assyrians were the first builders of major paved roads. Nineveh had, like the spokes of a wheel, major cobbled or stone paved roads that went out in all directions from Nineveh to other cities so that men in rapidly moving chariots behind horses could get to trouble areas very quickly, not with merely commercial purposes in mind, but the specific purpose of logistical support of rapidly moving military units in mind. The Assyrians revered woman, as is obvious from their various artifacts and their monuments, were the apparently first race in all of history to use iron in their chariots, and therefore armor and the mechanized equipment for war. The historian Pliny, Roman historian, called the Assyriani the group of people who inhabited the region north of the Black Sea that were already migrating over into North Central Europe. German historians, by the way, are united in their description of a hostile, warlike people inhabiting Central Europe who came into confrontation with the expanding Roman Empire, causing them to build their famous lemes or defensive positions and walls. Histories of Germany are unfailingly unanimous in their description of these tribes. Bear in mind, one of the most important names of the wandering lost ten tribes of Israel was Bet-Kumri that I've mentioned, which meant Beth-Omri. And bear further in mind that you're reading these descriptions in the English language, which finds its roots in the same Central European tongues as did the Franks, Celts, Angles, Saxons, and others, including High and Low German and Dutch. Bear in mind, too, that we tend to identify various racial and tribal groups by the names attached to them by the most literate of the ancient civilizations with whom they came in contact, not by our modern English. Thus, it is to the Roman historian Tacitus, as well as others, that were indebted for a description to some of these wandering tribes. The Romans spoke of the invading tribes in Central Europe as being two distinct groups of peoples who later separated, the Cimbri and the Teutons. In a book called Germany by Sabine Baring-Gould, and this is in the Tyler Library, he says, and I quote, "These invaders called themselves the Cimbri and the Teutons." Later, speaking of the modern Swiss, he said, and I quote, "There are two bilingual and biracial characteristics in Switzerland. This is because two distinctly different races lived together in Switzerland as they did 113 years before Christ. The French-speaking people represent the Cimbri." Interesting that the French that we know of as part of the northern ten tribes of Israel, even in Switzerland, are identified as the ancient Cimbri or Humri from Omri, and the German Swiss are identified as Teutons. Interestingly enough, Baring-Gould says the Germans were called from the spears they carried, and I've mentioned that. The Encyclopedia Americana under the article Germany says, and I quote, in 113 BC, when the first Germanic tribes, the Cimbri and the Teutons, attempted to break into the Roman Empire, the Germanic frontier became a major problem for maintaining the security of the Roman world. They were wandering together because they had been united together. Now, you know in history that the ancient Babylonian Empire conquered, subjugated, and drove out the Assyrians from their empire. Now, get it in mind, many, many years go by, possibly more than 250, but at least 127, 126 years between the time of the disappearance of the northern ten tribes of Israel into Assyria, the diminution of the Assyrian Empire, the rise to ascendancy of the Babylonian Empire, then God grouping certain prophets, among them Isaiah and others, warning the Judean kingdom in Jerusalem of an impending captivity to be imposed upon them by Babylonia. What had become of the hundreds of thousands of Israelites who had lived in the cities and towns of ancient Assyria when the Assyrians were driven out? You have the Cimbri and the Teutons, a warlike group of spear-wielding, harsh, fierce barbarians, together with another group of tall, blonde, fair-haired, reddish-haired, ruddy-faced, freckle-faced, they're all described that way, peoples who are distinctly different from the Teutons in Central Europe. And we find Jute land, the northern tip of the peninsula of Jutland, it's still called that today, And, of course, we know where that came from, the more than 350,000 that were carried away by Sennacherib of the Jews long before, actually, and who were emigrating up into that area. It's a fascinating study, of course, far too great for me to cover but a little tiny bit of it right now. But I want to take you through a few scriptures that are very, very important with regard to Assyria. And let's go to the book of Ezekiel, first of all, because of its time element. Ezekiel, the first chapter. We need to get a handle on the time in which this was written. I have here the Companion Bible, and he mentions, and I'll read it, with regard to the river Kabor, and then under the second verse, in the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiachin. Now, Jehoiachin was one of the next to the last kings of Judah, of the Judaic Empire, many, many years after all the Israelites had been gone, and when the armies under Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire, took him captive. He, remember, was in prison. And Ezekiel is what? He's a captive slave by the river Kabor, or Kibar, verse 2, under that whole group that were taken captive by Jehoiachin. I don't know whether this year is right. Some have said as much as 565, some have said 485, but the earliest toward the time of Christ it could be would be about 485 B.C. That renders it even farther from the removal, 721, 718. All you got to do is subtract 718 from 485 B.C. and see the years you're dealing with when the Israelites had been gone. Now, here's the fascinating part of the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel has chapter after chapter of warnings about Israel going to Assyria. Does it make any sense? But you see, Ezekiel has chapter after chapter written about the second coming of Christ, about the resurrection of David, about the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth, about the regathering of Israel into its own land, about the resurrection of all of Israel in Ezekiel 37, 38, and 9, about the regathering even of the Gentiles that are old estates in the final chapters of Ezekiel. So you need to know, what is the time element of Ezekiel? If you go to the 18th chapter, let's go 16, I'm sorry, the 16th chapter, is one good case in point. Here is the prophecy about Ahola and Aholibah, and it talks about the land of Jerusalem, Judah, and so on. And it says, beginning in verse 28, you have played the whore also with the Assyrians because you were insatiable. Yea, you have played the harlot with them, and could not be satisfied. You have moreover multiplied your fornication in the land of Canaan unto Chaldea, and yet you were not satisfied herewith. He goes on to call her an harlot because of the dealings of these people with the Assyrians. In the 23rd chapter, in verse 5 of the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel 23 and verse 5, is Ahola and Aholibah in this chapter, not the 16th. Ahola is Jerusalem, Samaria, I'm sorry, is Ahola, and Jerusalem is Aholibah. Notice in verse 5, and Ahola played the harlot when she was mine. She doted on her lovers, on the Assyrians, her neighbors, which were clothed with blue, captains and rulers, all of them desirable young men, horsemen, riding upon horses, showing again a martial kind of a kingdom. Thus she committed her whoredoms with them, with all them that were the chosen men of Assyria, with on all on whom she doted. With all their idols she defiled herself. Neither left she her whoredoms brought from Egypt. And I won't go into all the description here, but it's describing in condemnation both Israel and Judah, showing that Israel is having political, military, economic, etc., concourse with the nation of the Assyrians, and yet here it is many, many years after that it occurred. Now, it may have been written as a reflection back, but look at the book of Hosea for a moment and turn to a couple of important chapters in the book of Hosea. After Daniel, before Joel, Hosea chapter 5, first of all, and verse 13. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, Ephraim being one of the leading tribes of the northern 10 tribes, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb. It's a curiosity that even though you can find every known name on every monument that defines the two former and latter, they have two dynasties they generally deal with in Assyriology. They can never find a King Jareb. His name is not there. They can't try to find some other pronunciation of the Hebrew language for Jareb and try to find which name is this. Is it Sennacherib? Is it Ashurnazarpal or Ashurbanipal or who is it? And they cannot find such a king in history. Is it because there was no such and that he is merely symbolic? Yet could he not heal you nor cure you of your wound? Now today, Britain and the United States are allied together in NATO with the ancient Assyrians, or in other words, the German nation of people, our former arch enemies of World War II, a nation that descended into barbarism unparalleled in any history of mankind, a nation which is going to do it again. In the 7th chapter of Hosea, and verse 11, Ephraim also is like a silly dove without heart. They call to Egypt. Now, of course, right now today, the British are assisting the Egyptians in minesweeping the Suez. They go to Assyria. When they shall go, I will spread my net upon them. I will bring them down as the fowls of heaven. I will chastise them as their congregation hath heard. Somehow their congregation has to hear that message. In verse, let me go on here a little further. In the 8th chapter and verse 9, for they are gone up to Assyria, speaking of Israel. Verse 8, Israel is swallowed up. Now they shall be among the Gentiles as a vessel wherein there is no pleasure. For they are gone up to Assyria, a wild ass alone by himself, speaking of Ephraim. Ephraim has hired lovers. Yea, though they have hired among the nations, now will I gather them, and they will sorrow a little for the burden of the king of princes. Because Ephraim has made many altars to sin, altars shall be made unto him to sin. There are many other scriptures that deal with this, but I'm going to skip along and give you just a few of them. 12 and verse 1 of the book of Hosea, and it says, Ephraim feeds on wind and follows after the east wind. He daily increases lies and desolation, and they do make a covenant with the Assyrians, and oil is carried not into, but through, as it should read, Egypt. The Eternal has a controversy with Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways, according to his doings, will he recompense him. Now, this is at a time which strongly suggests both Judah and Israel in an alliance of some sort with Assyria. Yet Ezekiel is written at least 120-some-odd years after Israel has already gone into captivity and is condemning Israel, which has already disappeared from sight, for alliances with Assyria. Here is Hosea doing the same thing, as do other chapters of the Bible. Let's turn to Isaiah now, the 10th chapter, and verse 5. Isaiah 10 and verse 5, and a few more in the book of Isaiah. Now suddenly the whole situation changes. From a time of apparently alliance, friendship, and cooperation, listening to what is coming out of Germany, leaning upon them financially and economically and militarily, etc., now we see, God says, chapter 10, verse 5 of Isaiah, O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. I will send him against an hypocritical nation. Against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey, to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Howbeit, he meaneth not so. That's an interesting scripture. Neither doth his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and cut off nations, not a few. There is a biblical statement that the national and the racial characteristic of the Assyrian people is to glory and to exult in warfare and in conquest, and they have always done it down through all ages. There was nothing better known than the old Junkers family and the old Prussians with their saber scars. And, of course, the entire world, including the United States in the Revolutionary War, sought to the Hessians and the Prussians, the most famous military schools in all the world, clear back at the turn of the century and on into the tens and teens in our early history, were in Prussia. Prussian militarism is a subject of vast literary interest. There are histories that are replete with the entire history of that time. And it's going to happen once again in the nation of Germany. And all you got to do is go there. I mean, like I've been so many, many times. And you are instantly struck by the first time you walk through customs at the look and at the activity going on inside of Germany. And you can talk, as I have, to so many American families who have been over there either because they worked. Like, I knew one of my school chums' husbands was a pilot for Pan Am, running one of the three corridors, you know, to Berlin. And she said the same thing. And so many of them who have lived over there, because America, of course, has had tens of thousands of American troops' contribution to NATO. And I have talked to a lot of those leaders myself, including one of the top German aces that shot down 104 Allied aircraft during World War II, Adolf Gullit, who built, by the way, and put together the Argentine Air Force. And let me tell you, there are military people. I won't belabor that any further. Isaiah 14:25. Now, let's look very quickly at a few scriptures that are very important. Verse 25 of the 14th chapter. I'm going to break in the middle of it just to give you the key scriptures. I will break the Assyrian in my land, and upon my mountains tread him underfoot. How are you going to deal with that? The Assyrians were broken and trodden underfoot anciently in their own land. And so far as any histories are concerned, nobody knows who they are and where they went. You don't just look up the article Assyria and somebody tell you it's modern Germany. You've got to very carefully ferret it out through many, many different leads, as I have said here, giving you a few of them in this message today. You will not find a history book in the world anywhere, not in Germany, not in England, not in this country, that says Germany is ancient Assyria. But ancient Assyria was subjugated, driven out, dispossessed of their land by Babylonia. But here's the prophecy that says Assyria is to be broken in Palestine, in my land, says God, in this verse, 25th verse of the 14th chapter of Isaiah. And his yoke, read Isaiah 47, where it shows that the great universal church is going to lay its yoke upon God's people. His yoke shall depart from off them, and his burden depart from off their shoulders. And I won't read all of the rest of that to give you a few more. Isaiah 11 and verse 11, one of the most important chapters in the Bible about the regathering of Israel and the resurrection. It shall come to pass in that day, notice verse 10, read up to it, you can see what time it is talking about. In verse 5 through 9 is the description of conditions on the earth during the millennium, during the reign of the kingdom of God. Verse 10, and in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, Christ, which shall stand for an ensign to the people, to it shall the Gentiles seek. Now it's time for even Gentile races to achieve and to receive salvation. And his rest, his kingdom, shall be glorious. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, mentioned first, and then, of course, Egypt, Patros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and the islands or coastlands of the sea. He shall set up an ensign for the nations, verse 12, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Notice a little later on in verse 15, the Eternal will utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and with his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river, and shall smite it in the seven streams, and make men go over dry shod, and there shall be an highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt. So this is talking about a modern day end time exodus, just like the ancient exodus in Egypt when captives who have been in slavery of Israel will come out of captivity and will be regathered into their own land. Isaiah 19:23. Another reference, Isaiah 19, verse 23. In that day, and again you can read up to it, and you know that it says God is going to smite Egypt, and these five cities in the land of Canaan will speak the language of God, and so on. It's a day of destruction. In that day there shall be an highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptian shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Eternal of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people. And he's always said that they are pagan and heathen and under God's condemnation previous to this time. And Assyria, the work of mine hands, and Israel, mine inheritance. Again, a picture of the beginning of the millennium, the kingdom of God, the regathering of not only Israel, but her tormentors and her captors, all of them together. And who are they? Assyria as well as Egypt. And it showed a little later on in verse 20 a great deal about Assyria too, and about Assyrians even leading away Egypt captive. Verse 4, the king of Assyria shall lead away the Egyptians prisoners. We read in Daniel 11 from verse 40 to the end, the land of Egypt shall not escape. Over in Isaiah 27 and verse 13, just a couple more here, 27 and verse 13, it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, talking about the second coming of Christ and the last plagues, and they shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria and the outcasts in the land of Egypt and shall worship the Eternal in the Holy Mount at Jerusalem. I won't read the rest of these. There are many, many more in the book of Isaiah as well, but let's turn to Zechariah 10 and verse 10 to conclude here. Zechariah 10 and verse 10. And it says, I will bring them again also out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria. Israel has never returned to Egypt. The time of this prophecy is obvious. And I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon, and place shall not be found for them. And he shall pass through the sea with affliction, and shall smite the waves in the sea, as we read in Isaiah. And all the deeps of the river shall dry up, and the pride of Assyria shall be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away, and I will strengthen them in the Eternal, and they shall walk up and down in His name, says the Lord, or says the Eternal. Again, a prophecy of the second coming of Christ. So here's what we have. Ancient Assyria took the northern ten tribes captive. Allegedly, all histories say they both disappeared. There is no history book that says to you, other than what we have ferreted out and gleaned, and what others have done before us, as to who are the people of the United States, Britain, the Dutch are Zebulon. I know that and can prove there's even a whole book about the Dutch being Zebulon, by the way, that I have in my office, and other people not related to us or in any religious connection at all have come up with on their own. And it is taken merely from the prophecies as to what would happen, and the Zebulon, the tribe of Zebulon, would actually get their wealth out of the sea. And here is a nation that is basically below sea level, a nation of oil, a seafaring nation, a nation of lands reclaimed from the oceans. You have here, then, in all the prophecies we put together, clearly an alliance of some sort on the part of modern-day Israel with a modern-day remnant or the modern-day nation representing Assyria. Later on, who do you see? The chief captors or the antagonists of Israel at the time of the second coming of Christ? Assyria. All you've got to do is to identify Israel and identify ancient Assyria, and you've got a very strong clue about who does what to whom. And every bit of world history up to this time, and I believe the development of world affairs right now and in the future, point to that being a very accurate understanding of biblical prophecy. The key, we read, is the abomination of desolation, which we know will be both a Roman Catholic and a multilateral European force moving into Jerusalem, stopping sacrifices if they get started, which still may be in the offing, and also the 11th chapter of Daniel showing what begins perhaps as an invitation to come in and make what the Pope has called Jerusalem into a corpus separatum or an internationalized open city to preserve the holy places from warfare, which they suspect is going to get started in the Middle East. And it is then that the scenario we saw of people in Jerusalem, in Judea, being in the field or on the housetop, could be understood literally, where they wouldn't even take time to come down into their house or to return to their home out of the field, but would simply try to creep away and to save their lives if they possibly could at that time. It all fits and it all makes sense. What doesn't make sense is to be continually telling God's people we're about to flee. When I don't know who is the king of the north yet, I don't see any of that developing immediately. There is no temple in Jerusalem. There has been nothing happen which has brought about a great resurgence in national religion in the land of Israel. There has been no attempt that I know of to even dedicate a cornerstone for a new building, though every now and then some religious publication or other will sort of speculate about it, because others, other than we, understand that that might be a pivotal point of the developing of biblical prophecy. But if someone tells you we might flee by the feast, or we're about to escape by the Passover, or the time is really close, all they're doing is using fear to get you to part with your money, to keep you kind of on the gun lap, one foot in the air, poised to run somewhere, and they don't know what they're talking about. NATO has got to disintegrate. There's got to be a falling out between West Germany and the United States and Britain. There has to be the reunification of Germany. There has to be the coming out from behind the Iron Curtain of such nations as Czechoslovakia, Poland, perhaps Romania, the one nation that defied the Soviet Union in the Olympics. Great, monstrous, geopolitical, economic, military upheavals have got to occur before a multilateral European force is going to march into the Middle East and occupy Jerusalem. Don't let anybody tell you we're about to flee. I think God has given us the understanding of the overall outline and the overall scenario of biblical prophecy from now on. And I know that Christ gives us the one specific clue for which we are to look when you see the abomination of desolation stand in the holy place where it ought not, when you see Jerusalem surrounded with armies, then let them which be in Tyler, Texas, do what? It doesn't tell you to do anything. You'd probably be wanting to do a lot of praying at that time. You'd be very concerned. But them which are in Judea had better flee. If they're going to occupy Jerusalem, why should I flee if I'm in Tyler?